This is a podcast by The Straits Times.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to Speaking of Asia, a podcast by The Straits Times. I'm Ravi Velur, and I'm the paper's senior Asia columnist. In this episode, I speak with the respected Myanmar watcher Richard Horsey. Mr. Horsey is a senior advisor with International Crisis Group and has tracked Myanmar's politics and economy for 25 years. He also speaks fluent Burmese. Today, we shall speak with him in English. Welcome to Speaking of Asia, Mr. Horsey.
Thanks very much for having me on, Ravi.
Richard, you've been following Myanmar for a quarter century, and you speak the language. Can you tell us what is happening in the country today?
Well, you know, after the military coup in February 2021, the country has gone in a very dark direction. The military has used enormous violence to hang on to power against a popular resistance movement that started as, you know, a million people out on the streets of Yangon. I was there on the days following the coup. It was really an incredible outpouring of anger and determination from all walks of life to get back to the situation before the coup. Unfortunately, that didn't happen, and a lot of violence was unleashed against the demonstrators. And that morphed then into an uprising, into a resistance movement that took up arms to fight against the military. And we've seen over the last 4 to 6 weeks a real uptick in the level of armed conflict, particularly from ethnic armed groups that have been around for a long time, and these post-coup resistance forces as well, who've really, you know, stepped up the extent of their operations against the Myanmar military.
You know, looking in from the outside, it does look like Shan State, which is the state bordering China, that seems to be the province that seems most shaky at the moment. Is that a correct assessment?
That's where the current operation, so-called Operation 1027, that started on the 27th of October, that's where it started. Three armed groups with territory along the Myanmar-China border. But after that, there's been a kind of chain reaction, and a lot of other anti-regime forces, both ethnic armed groups and these post-coup resistance forces, have launched attacks across a wide area of the country, you know, quite far from Shan State. So the most intense fighting and the biggest gains of the anti-military groups has certainly been in Shan State, but there's lots going on elsewhere as well.
That's right. What about the states bordering India, such as the Chin State and Sagaing?
So we've seen in recent weeks that resistance forces on the Indian border have also seized a significant trade point in Chin State and a number of other strategic locations as well. And, you know, more broadly in Myanmar, after these initial attacks in October in northern Shan, I think other resistance and anti-military forces have seen this as a moment of historic Myanmar military weakness. They saw how quickly those groups in northern Shan achieved their tactical aims, how little resistance the Myanmar military units put up, and they concluded that now was the time to go on the offensive.
What about the people who live next to Thailand in the southeast, the Karens?
So the main Karen armed group, the Karen National Union, has also resumed fighting since the coup. It's allied with a number of People's Defense Forces. These are post-coup popular resistance forces. And it's been attacking both in its areas of traditional operation, but also expanding that into areas that the KNU hasn't really been able to operate in since the 1990s.
Richard, you mentioned about the military seemingly giving up pretty quickly or too easily. What does that say about morale within the troops? And is it true that the army, the military, is using more standoff weapons like artillery and air force strikes rather than the infantry going in, which would mean troops with fairly high morale?
So certainly in northern Shan, the picture has been of the Myanmar military giving up bases after very little fight in some cases. Some cases fighting, but in many cases giving those bases up without a fight. I think one of the reasons for that is that the Myanmar military moved a lot of forces out of Shan State, which has not seen a lot of conflict since the coup until now, and put them into other theaters where there was more intense conflict. And that left them understaffed, undermanned in Shan State. But there's other things going on. Clearly, there is a morale problem, and clearly there is a manpower problem. Whether it's as serious as some analysts have suggested, I'm not sure, but there's definitely problems there.
Richard, what about the political forces in the country? Do you see increased coordination between the opposition political forces and the various ethnic organizations, or are they fighting their individual battles?
They all share a common enemy. They're all fighting against the Myanmar military and, since the coup, against the regime. And they have overlapping objectives, but they're not identical objectives. So the post-coup resistance forces, they're conducting a revolution. They want to change politics at the center. They want to get rid of the regime and fundamentally reform the Myanmar military. Whereas the ethnic armed groups, some of whom have been fighting for more than 70 years, they have fought against democratic governments, against authoritarian governments. They're not about changing power at the center. They are about fighting for greater autonomy for their own areas. So that difference means that imagining that all of these ethnic forces will unite and march on Naypyidaw is probably unlikely. But at the moment, they are finding a lot of common objectives that they can agree on and coordinate on. So there's partial coordination, I would say.
Richard, Myanmar is a nation with a very powerful clergy. The Buddhist clergy is said to be quite influential. What role are they playing in all this?
What's been interesting since the coup is that the Buddhist clergy, the Buddhist Sangha, has played a fairly low-key role. There have been individual exceptions to that. There have been some top monks who sided quickly with the regime and saw, you know, a chance to enhance their prospects by attaching themselves to military power. There have been other monks who've been quite prominent in voicing resistance and anti-military messages. But for the Myanmar monkhood as a whole, they've been relatively low-key. And I think there's a number of reasons for that. One is that the coup happened during COVID, and the big monasteries weren't full of monks in the cities as they often would have been. The big teaching monasteries and the big practicing monasteries had sent the monks home to their home areas because of the risk of COVID transmission. But also, the resistance to this coup is a younger generation. It's a younger generation that doesn't necessarily want to follow in the same footsteps of power and the division of power as the past. And so as we've seen this young generation come to the fore in these demonstrations, we've seen a much more multi-ethnic, multi-religious approach to things rather than deference to old power centers. And I think that's also had an impact on the extent of monkhood involvement in the coup.
Richard, you have a keen sense of the economy, and you worked for the International Labour Organization. How damaged is the Myanmar economy?
I think it depends if you look from the macroeconomic perspective or from the perspective of ordinary people.
Let's do both.
Of course. For ordinary people, the coup has been devastating. There's been a withdrawal of foreign investment. Businesses have closed. Huge loss of jobs. And at the same time, we've seen significant inflation in the cost of ordinary goods and services. And that's really pushed many, many people in the country to breaking point. Strangely, the macroeconomy has been relatively resilient. So yes, the chat has lost half its value. Inflation is running at maybe 20%. But this is not a particular outlier in the region or globally. And Myanmar hasn't faced the kind of huge macroeconomic crisis that places like Sri Lanka or Pakistan or Argentina are facing. And there's a real question of why that is. How can Myanmar go through the twin shocks of COVID and a coup and all of the violence and disruption that's happened and yet be, relatively speaking, macroeconomically stable? And I think, you know, part of the answer to that is that Myanmar is an informal economy. It's an economy that's not a very modern, connected economy. But part of the reason is that probably half of Myanmar's economy is illicit. It's the drug trade, it's scam centers, it's natural resource extraction. And these things, which aren't all recorded in GDP figures, many of those things have boomed since the coup. And that's, I think, a part of the sort of dark matter in the macroeconomy that isn't recorded but explains Myanmar's resilience.
Very interesting, Richard. How would you describe the mood among the ordinary people in the country? Would you say they're fatigued, they're indignant, they're hopeful?
I would say they're traumatized. They're carrying an enormous amount of trauma from the sudden shift as a result of the coup, from the horrific violence afterwards, from the uncertainty about the future. Many of them have committed themselves to the anti-coup resistance and have paid a heavy personal and family price for that. But even people who are just trying to get on with their daily lives, you know, on the surface of things in Yangon or Mandalay, life looks pretty normal. People are going to the shops, restaurants and bars are open. There isn't a heavy security presence in many areas. And yet it's not. If you talk to people, if you scratch below the surface, things are not normal at all. Life is not normal. And people's hopes for the future are completely different than they were the day before the coup. And people were looking forward to Myanmar joining the mainstream of Southeast Asia. They were looking forward to their children achieving the aspirations of other young people in the region. And now that's all gone.
We'll come to broader Southeast Asia in a second. But just before that, could I ask you, there's talk that the country may come apart. And I saw Senior General Minong Hlaing says something to that effect recently. What is your assessment? Could Myanmar splinter?
You know, we should never discount the possibility that state failure can lead to really dark places. I mean, one should never discount that. I think, you know, it's not my operating hypothesis that Myanmar will devolve into a kind of violent situation that is irredeemable. You know, the kind of thing that we see in the Eastern Congo, the kind of thing we see in Somalia. This is not my default assumption. One should always be wary about these things. There's always further that a country can fall. You know, we should never assume that countries have reached the bottom. But Myanmar over decades has shown a certain resilience, which is kind of surprising. There have been wars going on in upland areas which have left the cities unaffected. You can go to one town and see normal thriving commerce when there's a conflict happening in the next town over. And, you know, Myanmar's politics and political economy and society has had so much experience of this over decades and decades. It's been a country that's seen patches of normalcy, but also large areas of conflict since the Second World War. And so I think there is a resilience there. You know, Myanmar is used to operating in that way. And so I think, you know, it's not easy to reach a tipping point where it goes to the next level of violence, but it's not impossible.
Richard, let's talk a bit about the wider region. Have you spotted increasing geopolitical activity in and around Myanmar? And who are the most active forces or powers there?
We've certainly seen over the last few years a rising great power contestation in the region between the US and China. That's pulled in other countries as well. I think the positive thing is that Myanmar hasn't really got drawn into that great power rivalry. Myanmar is one of those topics on which the US and China don't radically disagree. They may disagree on what to do about it. They don't radically disagree on their assessment or their interpretation. And in fact, beyond that, I think within the United Nations Security Council, there's a general consensus about what's going on and how to see the situation, albeit there are differences on the level of comfort with taking action. And so I hope that continues. I think it would be very bad for Myanmar and the wider region if Myanmar did get pulled into that contestation. But nevertheless, we see the impact that geopolitics can have on Myanmar. We see that India, for example, which many had hoped as a great democracy, would have sided with the democratic forces and has instead taken an ultra-pragmatic approach of engaging with the Myanmar military. And that's come at very little cost to India. You know, it's not as if within the Quad, for example, India is being grilled on why it is that it's adopting this cynical realpolitik, as some would call it. The geopolitics has also, I think, made itself felt with Russia, right? After Russia's invasion of Ukraine and Myanmar coup, Russia and Myanmar have kind of found themselves both in a very dark place and mutually embraced. I think that's to the detriment of the region and to the detriment of the peoples in both countries. But the geopolitics has allowed that kind of situation to happen. And then with China, I mean, China is very unhappy with the coup. China did not want to see this coup, does not like the situation, doesn't see it as being in its interests. But China isn't about to, you know, allow the UN Security Council to take serious action or to back sanctions or anything like that. China will operate in the way that China always operates, especially with countries in its backyard, directly, mostly quietly, sometimes in public. And China is the country which has the biggest impact on how events unfold in Myanmar, both politically and economically.
Staying on the subject of the region, Richard, how would you characterize ASEAN's role in Myanmar? Has it helped Myanmar in any way, or has it hindered?
I can't think of any other global context in which there is almost absolute global unanimity on what to do about something. And there is almost absolute global unanimity that ASEAN should take the lead on the Myanmar crisis. The UN Security Council consensus agrees to that. The regional countries agree to that. The Western powers agree to that. Even Russia agrees to that. Why is this? It's not, I think, because everyone else thinks that ASEAN will have that magic ability to transform events in Myanmar. I think it's because others do not want to take the lead, and somebody has to take the lead, and so everyone else can agree that the regional grouping should be the one. So the problem then for ASEAN is that expectations are very high, but the practical ability of the grouping to really achieve much is quite limited. And so I think for ASEAN, given the diversity of views within the organization, the different governments who don't look at this all in the same way, given the critical relationships they have with their dialogue partners, ASEAN's main priority is just not to split on this issue, not to make Myanmar the issue that puts a crack down the center of ASEAN. And secondly, they don't want the Myanmar issue to poison their relationships with important dialogue partners. Those are the priorities of ASEAN. Only third comes what can they actually do about the situation. And that's not because there's a lack of care, I think. I think many ASEAN leaders and senior officials would very much like to see an improved situation in Myanmar. It's because Myanmar is one of those places that is very resistant to outside influence and leverage. And frankly, as an organization that is based on consensus and non-interference, ASEAN isn't the kind of organization that carries a big lever in any case.
Very interesting remarks, Richard. You know, the Indonesian Special Envoy's office on Myanmar will soon hand over its work to the Laotians to pursue. From what I understand, the office has held dozens of meetings in Myanmar with various groups. Has there been any progress made?
So from my understanding, and I haven't had a full brief from the office about all of their activities, but from my understanding, you know, there's been a lot of effort put in. There's no doubt that the Indonesians have really tried as hard as they could and thrown some political capital at this as well. And that's meant that they've been able to have these hundreds of conversations with all the different sides of the picture in Myanmar. But what that adds up to, I think that's the real question. And the fundamentals of this is that the regime is not interested in compromise, and it's not interested in a graceful way out of this crisis. The regime is determined to hang on at all costs and crush, as it calls it, the terrorists. That is the pro-democracy resistance movement that came up after the coup. The regime is willing to talk to the old adversaries, the ethnic armed groups. It's not willing to have a dialogue, at least at this stage, with the resistance forces. And the resistance forces, on their part, they feel that they have momentum behind them. They feel that they have the support of the country behind them. They feel that they have the legitimacy. And they're not about to cut deals with the military either. And in such a situation, it's just very hard, no matter how many friendly meetings you have, it's very hard to really move the needle. And my sense is that the regime has never been invested in this process. So Indonesia has been pushing against a mostly closed door in Naypyidaw. Naypyidaw has rolled out some friendly people with smiles on their faces to have nice conversations, but it's not attached to anything. Those people are not mandated by the senior leadership or, you know, interested in really finding a solution.
Richard, you began by speaking about the coup in February 2021. We are approaching the third anniversary of that coup. Is there even a slim chance that the military might actually call for elections and try civilian rule as a bomb?
So I think, you know, the military has said since shortly after the coup that its planned exit strategy was to hold elections. I think that is their plan. I don't think they have a plan B. I don't think they're thinking about any other options or exit strategies. They want to hold a new election, fix the problems as they see it with the prior situation, this uncomfortable power sharing between the military and a populist political party and Aung San Suu Kyi at the head of it. They want what was originally intended under the 2008 constitution, the military sharing power with a nationalist pro-military political party, and then they can kind of agree on most things. So I think that's where they would like to get to eventually, a return to constitutional rule, but with the democracy element kind of cauterized. But they're having an enormous amount of difficulty getting there. And I think we also shouldn't rule out that Min Aung Hlaing himself has some personal ambitions here, that he may be getting very comfortable sitting at his desk in the commander-in-chief's office running this junta, that maybe he's not very interested in changing to a more risky situation where politics gets opened up, even if only a little bit, and if only among the elite. So elections may be at some point. I don't detect that the regime is in any great rush.
Very wise words from Richard Horsey. Richard, thank you so much for coming and speaking of Asia.
It's been great to speak with you, Ravi.
And that's a wrap for Speaking of Asia, a podcast series by The Straits Times. I'm Ravi Velour. Don't forget to share this podcast with your friends and family. If you'd like to read my articles, we have links in our podcast show notes below.
That was a podcast by The Straits Times. Send your feedback to podcast@sph.com.sg. Find us on Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or via the Google Voice Assistant and Amazon Alexa-enabled devices. For more podcasts by The Straits Times, The Business Times, and Money FM 89.3, you can also download the Audio by SPH app. That's AWEDIO.